You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO has a mobile app. You can listen to all your favorite shows, subscribe to KBOO podcasts, even set KBOO as your alarm clock. Just look for KBOO on the iTunes and Google Play Store. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review.
Want an impactful way to volunteer for KBOO? Believe in KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change? Then apply to be a member of the KBOO Board of Directors. Our KBOO board guides our strategic work and represents the interests and visions of all our members. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm and fill out an application. If you need a paper copy mailed to you, call the station or email applicationboard@kboo.org. That's one word, applicationboard@kboo.org. The deadline to apply is July 25th, 2020.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, keeping Portland safe and in touch. Community radio has never been more important than right now, and you can donate via the KBOO website at kboo.fm/give. There's also a donate button in the mobile app, but the best way to support KBOO is by becoming a member at kboo.fm/give. KBOO is a nonprofit, listener-supported community resource for people like you. This is Wider Window Poetry, and I am your host, Teal Ansari, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. As a latecomer to this region, I thank the Indigenous peoples of the Portland area for their stewardship of this land. KBOO Portland is located on land that includes traditional village sites of the Multnomah, Wasco, Cowlitz, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Bands of the Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Molalla, and many other tribes who made their homes along the Columbia and Willamette Rivers, creating communities and summer encampments to harvest and use the plentiful natural resources of the area. Portland is home to almost 70,000 people descended from these tribes and others, and KBOO thanks them. I do have a guest this month, but first I'm going to read a couple of poems by Bob Kaufman. Bob Kaufman was a beat poet and was one of the founders of the journal Beatitude, along with Allen Ginsberg and others. He was born in New Orleans in 1925 to a German Jewish father and a Black Catholic mother. As a young man, he joined the U.S. Merchant Marine, briefly studied at the New School in New York, and moved to San Francisco, where he associated with writers such as Gregory Corso, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and of course, Allen Ginsberg. He was a jazz-inspired street poet who adhered to an oral tradition. He proclaimed his poetry in coffee houses and on the streets and seldom wrote his poems down. But some of them were published through City Lights Bookstore, including The Broadside's Abominist Manifesto, Second April, and Does the Secret Mind Whisper? His works were also collected in Solitudes Crowned with Loneliness, The Golden Sardine, and The Ancient Rain poems from 1956 to 1978. And they were also republished in Cranial Guitar, Selected Poems by Bob Kaufman. I'm gonna read two poems. First, I'm gonna read an excerpt from Jail Poems, which is a very long poem. I'm just gonna read the first three sections. So this is from Jail Poems by Bob Kaufman. I'm sitting in a cell with a view of evil parallels, waiting thunder to splinter me into a thousand me's. It is not enough to be in one cage with oneself. I want to sit opposite every prisoner in every hole. Doors roll and bang, every slam of finality, bang. The junkie disappeared into a red noise, stoning out his hell. The odored wino congratulates himself on not smoking. Fingerprints left lying on black inky gravestones, noises of pain seeping through steel walls, crashing, reach my own hurt. I become part of someone forever. Wild accents of criminals are sweeter to me than hum of cops busy battening down hatches of human souls, cargo destined for ports of accusation, harbors of guilt. What do policemen eat? Socrates, still prisoner, old one. Part two. Painter, paint me a crazy jail, mad watercolor cells. Poet, how old is suffering? Write it in yellow lead. God, make me a sky on my glass ceiling. I need stars now to lead through this atmosphere of shrieks and private hells. Entrances and exits, in, out, up, down the civic seesaw. Hear me now, always here somehow. Part three. In a universe of cells, who is not in jail? Jailers. In a world of hospitals, who is not sick? Doctors. A golden sardine is swimming in my head. Oh, we know some things, man, about some things, like jazz and jails and God. Saturday is a good day to go to jail. And that was from Jail Poems by Bob Kaufman. And now, also by Bob Kaufman, Believe, Believe. Believe in this. Young apple seeds in blue skies, radiating young breast, not in blue-suited insects infesting society's garments. Believe in the swinging sounds of jazz, tearing the night into intricate shreds, putting it back together again in cool, logical patterns, not in the sick controllers who created only the bomb. Let the voices of dead poets ring louder in your ears than the screechings mouthed in mildewed editorials. Listen to the music of centuries rising above the mushroom time. And that was Believe, Believe by Bob Kaufman. This is Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest this month is Alex Dang, who was born and raised in Portland, Oregon, started performing poetry at 17 years of age, and hasn't slowed down since. He was on the Portland Poetry Slam national team in 2013, 2014, 2015, and 2016, making him the only Asian American poet in Portland's history to be on the team 4 years in a row. Alex earned his way to be the Eugene Poetry Grand Slam champion in 2014, 2015, and again in 2017. He's been a TEDx speaker for both the University of Oregon and Reno, Nevada. His work has been featured on Huffington Post, Upworthy, and Everyday Feminism, and has been viewed over 2 million times on YouTube. Alex is a proud graduate of Cleveland High School, yay Cleveland. He has performed in over 50 cities, 30 states, 7 countries, and he wants to know what your favorite food is. My favorite food happens to be mango.
Oh, see, and that's probably my mom's favorite food too. My mom's like the best cook ever, and I will always ask, like, what's your desert island meal? What's like your favorite meal? And she always says, fresh mango with white rice.
Oh, nice.
Right? Classic. Very simple, very easy. Thank you so much for having me on. I really, really am humbled and honored to be here. Can't wait to share my poetry. Thank you for inviting me to this community and for letting me read some poems.
Yeah, thank you for coming. Or, well, sort of, you know, since we're doing this all remotely here. So I'm going to go ahead and invite you to read for a while.
Thank you so much. And speaking of my mom, I think I'm going to start off with my mom's favorite poem. And look, last week, winter settled into me, made its way through until I turned into a shiver. And my father performs poetry by gifting me fleece pants. He puts his hand on my shoulder like a rucksack. My dad is a heartbeat, is a couplet, is an inhale, exhale reassurance. I'm in love with the poem, the greatest, most epic, unfinished poem that's still being written and lived. I read the poem at night before I sleep, and I wake up to excerpts of the poem in the morning. Small texts glow in my palms, every word a tiny miracle. Oh, you poem who contains so much poetry inside you, my almanac of like, my every good luck token. Someone is in love with me too, and often I will not believe it, would rather deny the love, fortress moat, barrier out feelings, close my eyes and hope I don't recognize the music. But even with my eyes closed, with my mouth shut, I smell a lilac in my chest. I press my hands against my ears and I taste mango. I open my eyes and there you are. That's the magic of a poem, our wild dedication. My mother performs poetry and I wake up to the loudest rainstorm, a cup of coffee my mom made before she left to work, and a little post-it note that says, heat pie less than 30 seconds. And now I have pie and coffee and clouds on their way to Earth for breakfast. And I leave my dad a poem in his voicemail and he helps me write the poem by taking me to lunch. And my oldest brother finishes the poem by calling in the middle of it and we put him on speakerphone and we laugh and smile. And soon this restaurant is another poem in our anthology of worlds and memories. We are a strange land built by rocks of any size. Woods from all corners, waters on every realm, brought here to nourish and feed our plot, to grow out of our potential, to eat with full hands and fuller hearts. The fruits of our love, the seeds we planted long ago, will bloom when they bloom. So until then, what we do is we tend, we nurture, we take care of each other, then we write again. And look, poems. And look, I love you. Next poem I wanted to read is a little funky one. I love being able to draw inspiration from anything and everything. I think everybody is unique in an individual and that we all like things for specific reasons. And I love getting to know why people like something. I'm a very big music person. I like a lot of hip hop. One of my favorite artists is Mac Miller. He passed away a few years, so I've been thinking a lot about him and his work. And I will occasionally go on weird Google rabbit holes, and I was re-familiarizing myself with Georgia O'Keeffe's work, and I thought that maybe Georgia O'Keeffe and Mac Miller might have been a good combination. So this poem is called Mac Miller and Georgia O'Keeffe Collaboration Track. Georgia O'Keeffe made at least 20 different paintings or drawings of the same door, but it's different every time because a morning can be gentle in the spring and blank bleak in the winter. So Georgia O'Keeffe had these doors is Mac Miller's favorite track off his critically acclaimed album, Good AM. He says in an interview that this is him excited again. The opening sets the tone for all of that. An entrance to a new beginning. The intro, the door of her ABQ ranch was the reason why O'Keeffe bought the place. I used to climb over the wall just to look at that door. And now I see a door is something you go through. And throughout her life, she kept staring, thinking, saying, I never quite get it. It's a curse. The way I feel, I must continually go on with that door. And I am always scared because doors will close and people change. Max sings in the opening of a door. There is a way in, yes, but a way out as well. And one day you'll go, O'Keeffe, my last door, oil on canvas, a black rectangle on white with gray. Right now, you're here. Today, I wake up a new person. Don't leave just yet. I open the door to my heart, to my home. Don't disappear. I will paint over and over, sing again and again, and never get it perfect. I'm starting on my 27th try. There's no right way to go through it, and still, we always get through it. Good morning. One of my favorite authors, Hanif Abdurraqib, he described his work kind of like a, because he used to be a journalist, so he described his work kind of like taking a photograph and exploding that moment for all it's worth. So I kind of felt that with this poem, where it is just essentially kind of a recalling of a very specific and literal moment in my life. And this poem is called On Trying to Explain to the Eye Rolls in English 395 Why It Always Has to Be About Race. For starters, because it is about race. For me, race is not an argument, debate, topic. Race is a shadow painted permanent on my first bedroom walls. I never noticed how dark it was until I got older and my eyes focused and my golden shine got brighter. try to imagine it like an optical illusion. Once you see it, you can't not see it. And so you keep watching this presence creep terrible with tendrils, the puzzle you can see through but cannot solve, a rolling thick fog that wraps around your frame and shakes your body until you shiver, but you can never let your voice tremble. This is not a debate. I hear your articulate arguments, you devil's advocate, which, by the way, why advocate for the devil? You've got polished shoes tied perfect on your tongue, and the way your contentions hold tension like the world's only dance floor is impressive. But now you can never take off that fancy attire. Someone is always looking at you. Picture your speech buttoned up every day. How tired your words must get, always being so armored and formal and infallible and endless fatigue. I would love to give it a rest, but I don't get to sleep it off. It is relentless. It wakes me up every time I start to dream. Nightmares are the only time it leaves me alone. So I don't sleep. I don't get to sleep, even if I wanted to sleep. And believe me, I do. I so want to badly close my eyes. I'm exhausted. A pair of good shoes. I received my diploma in these shoes. They're my dad's. He hasn't stepped in mine, but I've walked in his. How lucky. How wonderful. How do you walk in the same steps of your father? I don't. I can't. Just because the shoe fits doesn't mean we have walked the same paths, but we do have the same walk. And he walked so I could run. Told me that you don't run away from anything. So I take my time walking across the stage. I walk towards what is mine. I don't run in these. I don't run. I won't run. I'm gonna move it back to hip hop land, and I hope Kendrick Lamar comes back. I hear he's still doing shows and stuff. And I also hope Rihanna comes back. This is a poem based off of the music video of Loyalty from Kendrick's album Damn, and it also features Rihanna. I absolutely love the music video, and I guess you can say this is my play and take on an ekphrastic poem. I am looking at this visual medium and writing a poem about it. So yeah, I guess you could call this an ekphrastic poem. And it is entitled Loyalty Music Video Greatest Love Story Ever Filmed. Rihanna spits gum into a dude's car for the fun of it, and Kendrick finishes the fight for her because that's what love is. Then, because said dude disrespected the love, they steal his car to teach him a lesson. And that lesson is, love's gonna get you killed, but pride's gonna be the death of you and you and me and you and you and you and me. And that's the end of Romeo and Juliet, except in this version, lovers don't die. Everything that tries to kill them fails. Kendrick stands alone in the road, surrounded by masked assailants. Eventually, they rush towards the center where Kendrick, unbothered, sees the naysayers sink into the street. Still boasting about the loyalty he has forged, he watches those who are unfaithful fall into the ground around him. Then, the bad girl herself appears just to diamond duet the verses into something so good that you can't help but show it off. And that's not ego when you have pride in your love. There's no shame in putting everything you have in love and dying. And in this song, that's damn near impossible, so why be humble? Why not hang off the ledge holding only his hand? There are sharks swimming in the concrete and their feet are dancing around them like ripples on a pond, and Rihanna has her hands on the wheel and so does Kendrick, and now they're swerving in circles until a truck crashes into them and they laugh because it's ride or die, and it ends with the two of them being pulled under slowly, holding each other like they were slow dancing. Like, if you go down, then I go down with you. Depression diss track. Oh, if only we could walk this earth with a pocket full of curses ready to launch in the face of an adversary, ready to take on every problem, to release the basketball without fear of missing, equipped with infallible hearts, There's always music playing. I enter a room and they play my theme song. There's just a person, but there is more than just the words. It's the attitude and the braggadocio and the fuck it. If I'm better, then that's just fact, law, gravity. I hold you down and put the verse in the universe. Blade in the switch, my rate too accurate. I'm the one, like lonesome, like solitary solitude soliloquy. Like I'm rapping in the mirror and posing and posturing and smiling the entire time. All right, I'm gonna transition into something a little more serious, a little heavier, definitely a trigger warning and content warning. Lots of very strong racial language in this. Recently, I've been thinking about the idea of portraits and imagining yourself. But the thing about portraits or reflections or projections of yourself is that they are all different things. A mirror's reflection is not you, a picture of yourself is not you, and a picture of yourself is not even the same as a reflection of yourself. So I keep imagining what a portrait of myself would look like. I love seeing what artists do for their self-portraits of how they imagine themselves. But then I didn't know how to see myself. And so I started trying to look at myself from other lenses, from other views of the world, and I came up with this poem. Portrait of the Asian boy, but as the world sees him, or fuck you, it was a compliment, or I'm not racist, but what is your oriental name? Give me your delicate pronouncement made for you with one part mother, one part father, a word that holds an entire family of meaning in its syllables. Yeah, that one. Now butcher it for me. Leave out the weird shit, no intestines, no organ meats. I don't want to see your heart. Slice your name into bite-sized pieces. I hate getting food stuck in my teeth. I hate slow service. I yell the loudest and widest voice in a room filled with spineless servers, meals who know their manners, know their place to be removed like silk, like a condom, like off a checklist, a brown earth boy to be conquered. My white flag, your surrender. The takeaway is I take away everything. Buddhist trinkets you call sacred, I call museum donation. My friends call dope beads, bro. Oh shit, you got that from that chink store, right? The one that always smells like rotten fish, right? But I get it. There are differences. It's a cultural thing. It's an Asian thing. I get it. You're a thing. So don't get mad when I ask who manufactured you. I'm learning about your people. I'm reading the manual that came with your container. See? Model minority says right there on your box's label. It lists every way I can use you. You speak English so good. Tutor me in math. Where do I get that good foe? But you know what they say about Chinese food. You're hungry 20 minutes later. It's all good though, because these fobs are shipped in by the boatload, but they can't speak anything except that stupid robot language, all metal clanging and ching chang chong. So we replace the mouth with the Confucius platitude generator by day, oriental rug at night. Such an exotic lay, you respectful fuck, a dutiful fetish. Wow, no wonder there's so many of you. All the same, each one of you, a takeout container emptied. I mean, look at your sticker. It says, made in my interest. Do not disobey me. Otherwise, I'll cancel your show, Margaret Cho. I'll rip out your fangs, Liu Kang. I'll slap on buck teeth, turn you into a gong. Scream for me after I strike you. You people all own laundromats, right? You people know how two wongs make it white, right? You people know how to handle bleach. So why not pour it over your forever foreign dirty bodies? Look, look, your portrait is done. I made it for you myself. It's a white sheet of paper, endless possibilities. Hey, do you know how to fold origami? I want to make 1,000 of you so my wish will come true, then discard your corpses like wishing on a shooting star, guaranteeing my comfort out of your already dead, burning, and brilliant body. But sometimes when I get angry, I'll cry, which is kind of the opposite of what I'm trying to go for. I wield anger like a tool, and I am a bad craftsman with too many band-aids. when I raise my voice, is to show I can raise the roof beams myself. The spectacular show of shouting like a madman when really I'm not mad or sad. Really, it's like a confluence of two densities of water crashing into oneself, or two self, because they are both different and both water. So anger could be a storm and sadness would be a river, and it will always lead back to this grief ocean. And I think I've got one more longer piece. It's kind of more of a essay. And this is an essay that's forthcoming, that's gonna be published with University of Hell Press. Thank you to Greg Girding for inviting me to be a part of this anthology, where essentially he invited a lot of writers and artists to just talk about their experience of the year of 2020. Let's put it out there. The year of 2020 was a whole thing and a half. And right now the heat is going on, and it's almost been kind of a year-ish since all this has been happening, and I felt like it would be a nice appropriate piece to end my little poetry session. And it starts off with a quote by Hanif Abdurraqib, and the title of this essay is called The Upside of Being Down. God, can you tell me how much longer I'll get to be alive and in love? God, I'm sorry for the times I didn't want to stick around. Hanif Abdurraqib. And if you're hearing this, that means you've made it through to the other side of 2020. Friends, what a year it has been. I'm glad you're still here. I think a lot of us thought 2020 was going to be our year. I sure thought it was. I was coming out of 2019 with a breakup and randomly occurring seizures. I had left a job that I loved but wasn't cut out for. I kept running into wall after wall until I saw each obstacle was just me getting in my own way. I was ready for a new start. 2020 looked like the perfect place to begin. Listener, when I ask you, where do you come from, do you think of a place or a people? Does it hold you like a childhood bedroom? Do you think of what you've done? Do you come from the wreckage of your mistakes? Are you from a family or a country? Would you defend your home? Have you ever had to protect your loved ones? Did someone you care for say, see you tomorrow, and when tomorrow came, they had left? It seems like every day the world is ending, and every day it keeps going and gets worse and better and then so much worse, but hasn't this always been the case? When the wildfires began and Oregon burst into flames and the sky reddened and the smoke bellied the air, my dad said to me, "This reminds me of the day Saigon fell." My mom nodded, "Just like the war." People tell immigrants to go back to where they came from, and I wonder if they know the reasons why you would run in the first place. There are a lot of things to run towards. Opportunity for you and your family. A better, shinier life for your children. It's a matter of where you want to go, and that's always a matter of perspective. But when it's a matter of life or death, you aren't running towards something. You're running away from something. A death, a war, an ending. And when America yells, go back to where you came from, I want to ask, do you mean to the house your hands ransacked or to the grave you robbed? And when America demands us to be grateful for being here, I wonder if they have ever traced their lineage of blood and smolder back to the beginning. Do they know we are escaping a war they started? And America tells us how lucky we are for surviving. 2020 has left us gasping with questions. I am swallowed by the whys of it all. Why is this happening? Why didn't we listen? Why couldn't we have prevented it all? Stare through the window at the world falling apart, or turn my gaze inside and only see myself, myself, myself? To look inward and reflect on yourself is complicated. It's recognizing what you have inherited, what you have ignored, and what parts you need to improve. I see how extremely lucky and privileged I've been during all of this. The seizures are being treated, and I've been connected to my newly diagnosed bipolar depression, while figuring out my health situation, I've been staying with my parents. I'm actually speaking from my childhood bedroom right now, and I've had their continual support. There have been times when I had a seizure and my mom or dad or brother was there to catch me before hitting the ground. This is not a metaphor. I am so incredibly grateful and oftentimes will think I am undeserving of this love and care. I keep asking, why me? And every time, my friends and family will gently hold out a hand so I won't fall. They remind me until I start believing it for myself. In high school, I always felt like I was too emotional. And isn't it funny how I wrote this in the same room, considering those same feelings from a newer me? I am so much closer to my family now. Those emotions 18-year-old me would have struggled to understand are now the same ones I tell my brothers about, the ones I ask my mom how to deal with, the ones my dad checks up on. Oh, bless the younger versions of us, filled with truths and doubts, they who have so many reasons but are all out of excuses. The world caught on fire again and is still burning and is hot even as winter would creep in. When we look back at the year, what will we remember? America has looked within itself, and what do we see? When the embers die out and the world is ash and soot, what will sprout from the ruins? Who will survive the flames? Something new has grown inside of us. Reach into the earth of yourself and gather the harvest. What are you going to do with this bounty? Will you plant something for the next generation? What will you do with your hands? I have burst forth with anger and gratitude and sorrow and guilt and joy and anger and love and joy and joy. And I have seen friends and doctors and artists harness their rage into tools to build a new world. There are students and mentors and strangers shaping their sadness and anger and love into shields and homes, into hammers and poems. Friends, this was our year. And next year will be ours too, and the year after that, and the year after. It will always be our year to do something. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Well, I told myself that I would be over 2020 when I could read Amanda Gorman's poem that she read at President Biden's inauguration and not cry. And I actually don't think that's ever going to happen.
Nope. Nope. I mean, I think we need to call a spade a spade, and we should all address 2020 as a giant thing that happened to all of us. And that's what it is, right?
So hopefully, you know, we make it an opportunity and we make some things better than they were, because I don't believe we'll ever get back to normal.
No such thing. No such thing as normal. Never has been, right?
Yeah, so this is Wider Window Poetry on KBOO 90.7 FM. My guest this month is Alex Dang. So tell us about your upcoming projects. You mentioned the poem or essay that you just read is going to be in an anthology.
Yeah, the University of Hell Press, a local press in Portland, is run by Greg Girding, fantastic human being and a very, very great artist. He has an anthology coming out through University of Hell Press called, if I remember correctly, the final title was still being decided, but it was tentatively The Year of the Asterisk. And the asterisk, of course, kind of being all the different folks coming together with their stories. And I had such a hard time writing about this. It was, how do you sum up 2020? How do you sum up 2020? And I thought it was one of the hardest things I've ever written, because how do you encapsulate so much? And I had to keep focusing and almost both widening the lens and focusing it at the same time of trying to understand where the world's at, but also where I'm at. And I'm just very, very grateful that Greg Girding gave me the opportunity to be able to publish this essay. And I'm very, very excited to share it with the world.
So you mentioned kind of both the widening and the focusing. And I think that is the challenge for poets generally, mm-hmm. those who choose to write outside of themselves. And that sort of brings up another thing. You mentioned ekphrastic poetry, and you had the poem that was based on the music video mm-hmm. by Kendrick Lamar. But and also, I think the first poem that you read featured Georgia O'Keeffe and Mac mm-hmm. Miller in sort of an imagined dialogue. So, you know, in a wider sense, ekphrasis is not only a particular piece based on a particular other piece, but sort of this dialogue, this shared pooled inspiration among different arts. And yeah, I definitely don't see a lot of that in poetry, so that really stands out to me in your work. Do you do that a lot, and is it a conscious effort?
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I'm not sure if it's a conscious effort. I will cite and reference Hanif Abdurraqib a lot because he truly is one of my favorite writers, but he has many, many poems. And because he used to be a music journalist, he would often write about musicians, sometimes from a third person, sometimes about them doing different things, but it would always be an idea. He said that he imagines his poems as a vehicle, and the final destination is an emotion. So it doesn't matter what the vehicle is, as long as we get to the destination. And that's kind of how I imagine all kind of forms of art, of where are we going and how are you taking me there? And if I'm gonna be driving the car, I wanna take my favorite roads, I'm gonna put on my favorite music, I'm gonna make sure that everyone's okay, but if I wanna wind down the windows, I'm gonna wind down the windows because that's how I wanna get here. And with that being said, Hanif showed me how to be specific to yourself, but still speak to everybody. Where there's a lot of poems where it's just about the person and there's not a lot of relation, where you read it or you hear it and you kind of think, this is really, really, really specific to this one person. Like, this is an incredible story, but wow, I'm so glad they shared it with us. Versus a poem where it's like, that was a really personal poem, but they opened it up in a way to create dialogue and conversation. I'm never trying to have hard answers. I think I'm always trying to ask questions and then just kind of be like, and isn't that interesting? Now you guys can talk about it. So I'm always pulling inspiration from just anything that I'm consuming, anything that I'm watching. I have a couple of poems that are in the voice of my mom, and it's her telling me how to cook. I have some poems in the voice of my dad, and it's him telling me how to change brakes on a car. I have poems in the voice of my brothers who are teaching me how to play basketball. I have poems in the voice of like cartoon characters. I have a couple Naruto poems. I'm working on a lot of different fun things. I just like being able to share what I really like and then basically then asking the audience, now tell me what you like.
Do you find there's a difference? You know, a lot of your poetry, obviously, you've performed live or you've produced on video. So it's very much performance oriented. It's meant to be listened to versus meant to be read. Do you have much poetry that you've written that you know is basically probably more going to be read than listened to? And does that make a difference to how you approach it?
Oh gosh, this is the big million-dollar question for me, because I feel like I am a stronger performer, and I am always afraid. I always make that differentiation between stage poetry and page poetry because I come from slam poetry. I come from a performance background. There are some poems that clearly, if you're doing a lot of enjambment, if you're doing a lot of visual work, if it's a concrete poem, it's gonna look better on the page. But I always appreciate the challenge of how do I perform this weird poem on the page in real life? And then on the flip side of, oh gosh, this person's gonna be reading this poem, I can't modulate my voice. I can't show them my facial expressions. What are the equivalences that I can do to put into the page poem? And that's kind of where I'm at, because I feed off of the audience. I learn from their audience reactions and I learn what works and what doesn't work. And since I don't have an audience really anymore to perform in front of because it's all over screens, I've had to learn how to just trust my own voice and trust my own writing again. And that has been very, very scary. So the idea of these poems are going to be read definitely is sticking in my mind. And I'm hoping that when they read it, they will still be able to hear my voice. I try to write things in a way that hopefully does that double entendre of, okay, Alex is doing something visual on the page, but also if I read it out loud, it would do something different sonically.
That's a good trick.
I'm hoping, and this is where I learn a lot from music and hip hop and stuff, where it's just like that alliteration, the rhythms and stuff, the where you put the rhymes, where that internal heartbeat is. A lot of these things I learned from performance in theater. I used to do a lot of speech and debate. And speech and debate essentially is learning how to write very precise and concise things. It is claim, warrant, impact. And then I started thinking, well, what's my poem's claim? What is the warrant that I have? What is the impact that I want this poem to have? And now I'm thinking like a debater, but I'm writing poems.
So are you on the debate team at Cleveland?
Oh, yes, indeed. State champions for us. I got second in after dinner speaking when I was a senior in high school. I still remember it because I felt like I should have got first, but whatever. I'm not salty. I don't... But yeah, shout out to Mr. Gonzalez, who still teaches at Cleveland, who was my favorite my senior English teacher, one of my favorite teachers and mentors, taught me so much about writing and performing because he was the speech and debate coach, and he showed me how to perform for the judges, for the audience. And this was such a really, really eye-opening thing because speech and debate is so specific, and I feel like a lot of people believe poetry to be so ephemeral and general and kind of wishy-washy, but it's not all things have a point, even if the point is there is no point. But like that claim, warrant, impact really taught me who is this for, why am I doing this, and who am I speaking to. I never, ever want to speak down to my audience. I always want to try to look them in the eyes.
So that the debate training really gave you a rigorous approach, kind of a logical structure.
Yeah, and the fun part about speech and debate is, you know, that's the debate side of things. And then in the speech side of things, you're the dramatic interpretation, one of my events, is essentially you do a one-person scene and it's 10 minutes max. So I started to learn how to perform long form pieces. And I think the best thing that trained me was I would be performing in a room with judges who were parents who did not want to be there because it's a high school speech and debate tournament and it's very early in the morning. And they have to listen to like a bunch of high schoolers who are wearing ill-fitted dress clothes, trying to argue about debates, trying to argue about all these political things, trying to show people like, ooh, I can be an actor, I can be a performer. And while this is all happening, your audience is this one judge who is a parent who does not want to be there, it's early in the morning, and your five other competitors who will not smile, who will not show you any reaction, and you're essentially performing to an empty room filled with people. And I think the best trick I learned about that was if I went first, I would immediately burst open the room with so much energy that no one could top me. Or if I went last, then it'd be like, okay, I'm going to keep building. It was always me taking in so much information as a performer of like, if I go in the middle, oh, what is this judge responding to? Oh, she really liked that joke, so I think I'm going to hit the emphasis on this one. Oh, that judge liked that one, so I'm going to kind of switch it up a little bit. It was always me reacting to these different things. And I think that's given me that's informed a lot of my poetry work and a lot of my voice.
Well, that's fascinating. That's a background I haven't heard from any of my other guests on this show.
This is first for everything, right?
Yeah. So I wanted to, and I should mention that I went to Reed College, which is not far from Cleveland, you know, over there in Southeast, and we considered Cleveland the enemy at the time. So
wait, what did we do besides just be annoying high schoolers?
That was pretty much it, but I forgive you. It's okay that you went to Cleveland.
Oh my gosh. I, for some reason, I was looking up Cleveland and I saw the Google reviews for Cleveland. And one, why do schools allow reviews on Google? And two, why would you allow your students to write reviews? One of them was just like, the student body does not wash their hands. And it's like, wow, these are, I can't believe it had like a 1.5 star rating. Ugh. And I'm like, I kind of like Cleveland, but I also understand that's very real.
Yeah, you can't really prevent that kind of thing. You know, it's like Yelp. One person has a bad experience at right. one restaurant and they go write this terrible review. But and the 100 people that ate there that thought it was fine don't bother to write a review.
Exactly.
So you end up with this terrible rating.
But then again, there was a lot of comments about the lead water, which...
Well...
Right.
That was totally called for.
That was definitely called for. There was a lot of, hey, and there's a lot of sarcastic high schoolers being like, where's my tasty water? It had such good flavor in it.
All right. So on a more serious note, I wanted to ask you, and this really ties in with both, you know, the essay about 2020 and the poem about the portrait that you read before that. And so in the wake of COVID and, you know, calling it the Kung Flu and whatnot, there has been a big upsurge of kind of very overt racism against Asian Americans. And a lot of people are really surprised. They're like, gosh, where is this coming from? It seems all new. Mm-hmm. But certainly in your work, you know, the consciousness of it has always been there. And racism against Asians in America is certainly not new, but it seems like maybe it's become more overt or it's taken on a different form. Do you want to address that a little bit in terms of your work, your personal life, your family, or any community that you feel you could speak for?
And, you know, I think this is, you know, a really sticky situation and a very sensitive topic to talk about. And I will come into different classrooms. I will speak to a lot of different students. And, you know, a lot of them will be like, how do I deal with this? How do I approach it? And I always say just there's a U-shaped hole in the world. So you have to figure out how you fit yourself in the world. And I think if you understand where you are in your place in where you're standing in the map, that it will help you inform your decisions and where you want to go. And with that being said, I recognize that I am a half Chinese, half Vietnamese, American born, cis queer, like Asian male living in America. I realize that I do have some privileges. I do realize that I have some disadvantages, but that's just kind of what it is to be Asian American. And I think that the specificity of being Asian American is also very, it conflates a lot of different things. There's so much history with Asian Americans in America, but then I think it also gets mixed up with all these different narratives. We have the Korean War narrative, we have the Vietnam War narrative, we have the difference between Japanese people and Korean people, for example. There's so many small nuances where it's so easy to lump Asians together when there's so much other nuance. And then when Vincent Chin passed away and the term Asian American was coined, it was because the Asian community, all communities wanted to stand together in solidarity. And weirdly enough, that standing in solidarity has made us into a monolith in America's eyes. So when they see all these rising hate crimes, I feel like it's more just historical of like, this happened when I'm sure the Vietnamese refugees first came through, or I'm sure that this was happening when the Korean War was happening, or I mean, it was even happening when the auto workers were upset that Japan was taking their work. And there's always going to be a historical point and I think a reflection and a reason for these rises. But it always, I think, gets mixed up in a history of like, oh, well, you guys just got here. You Asian people just got here, which for a lot of us, that's true. A lot of us are first generations. And then there's a lot of us who have been here for years. And it's such a strange thing to conflate these two ideas. And of course, I'm often the first Asian person somebody meets. I mean, I grew up in Oregon, so I'm often that person. I'm often the person calling people in, kind of being the starter kit 101 of like, this is how you should speak to POC. And I realized over the years that if you don't have exposure to it, it's not going to be on your radar. And then when you start thinking about it, then how are you going to start thinking about it? So if you have no idea about Asian Americans, and then all of a sudden you hear Kung Flu, you hear the Yellow Plague, which I mean, by all means, these are very good rapper names for me, but you hear all of these different things and they get mixed up. No one knows the true history. I mean, we can say that about anything and everything. You read the plaques on parks and you realize that this person was not actually the greatest person. Why name a park after them? And all of these different rises in the crimes and the hate and all these different things, it really, really makes me consider what's the best way to be an ally. Because I don't want to take spotlight. I don't want to take up space that I shouldn't be taking up space. But then this is also a way of thinking of, why should I feel guilty about taking up space? What is informing that thought process? And so learning about my feelings before I put them out in the world has been 100% helpful. And sometimes I'm still going through those feelings where I'm still frustrated. I still don't 100% understand why people see Asian Americans differently, why we put these differences on each other. But until then, I am gonna do the best of my work, and knowing that I look the way that I look, that I speak the way that I speak, where I'm from, I'm going to just address it like that. I'm not gonna address being Asian American like an LA dude. I'm not gonna address being Asian American like a Korean person. I'm gonna address being Asian American like me. And I think the best way for anybody to help and to figure out more is to just have a real conversation with someone and get to know their ideas, get to know their thoughts, and to be curious, learn, ask questions, and, you know, read a book. But at the very end of the day, it's everyone's got a different history and a different personality. Even if you took another person who was the youngest brother in their family, three older brothers, mom, dad, favorite food is burgers, like all these different things. If you replicated Alex, but you made him grow up in Kentucky, he's gonna be a different Alex. So solidarity versus being a monolith. That's, I feel like, my big, big million-dollar question of, how do I show solidarity without just lumping myself in it?
That's a great takeaway. So we have a few minutes left. I'd like to have you read one more poem, your choice, and then I'm going to close with by asking you a completely random question.
Ooh, excellent. All right, one more poem, my choice. Interesting. What is a nice, I'm trying to think of, I was like, what have I written recently that I really, really enjoy? You know, this is an older poem, but I think this might, it's an older poem, it's a longer poem, but it is about America, and I feel like this is going to be relevant, especially considering our conversation just now. This poem is entitled America. Please read this poem when I am questioned for being a traitor to your way. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask, what can you do for the people you love? Ask, what can you do for your home? Ask, I remember all the times a customer tells me that they're a professional, reveals them and being, and they then just start shouting at me about Charlottesville, Charleston, Santa Fe. They tell me that it hits so close to home because a lot of his friends live in DC, Nevada, Florida, America. It really hits close. It hits so close to home. I ask if he wants his coffee for here or to go. But I wanna ask if this is the first time home has felt unsafe to him. I've never wanted to ask, Dad, what does chink mean? Mom, why don't our neighbors like us? Hey, brother, have you ever had a girl not be into you because you're like, well, you know? Ask anyone who doesn't look like you if they belong in this country. Ask them, where are you really from? How much do you love America? Show me your papers, bleed red, white knuckle forever, sing me your blues, verify your Americanness for me. I am your judge, jury, and 45th president. Now ask yourself, what is home? The house, the cabinet, or the people inside? They say America helps those who help themselves, and that's how we've gotten to where we are today. We have forgotten that two open hands clasp better than two closed fists. Grant us the strength to be each other's kindness. What a blessing to be the person you needed when you were younger and softer. I want to bask in your sunlight, and at every party we go to, I'm always going to tell the best stories about you. The greatest thing about us is our capacity to be everything and anything at will. With the wave of a finger and a flick of a switch, the cosmos ballet for us, and we make atoms go to war. This signature allows for all Americans' retirement and Japanese Americans to be interned. Oregon is so liberal and had the last KKK governor in recent history, we brushed the dirt off of our shoulders because that's what our angels and devils left behind for us. There's no more simple solutions of fate or flipping a coin or pretending to vote in the next election. We are all here today because we choose. Ask to choose the person on your left. Ask to hold the person on your right. Ask not what your country can do for you, but ask, is this my country? Am I proud to be American? The America I'm fighting for does not exist yet. The country I want to be a part of is not real yet. I've learned that to be American is paradox. Our history is grounded on the upheaval of one. This nation was built from dissent, revolution, and radicals. And again, my America is being rebuilt by dissent, revolution, and lovers. My America is so un-American. And that's what patriotism is in this country, demanding more from a good situation, making great out of a depression. I am not fighting for Kennedy's America or this America or Obama's America. I am not fighting you, America. I was born here. I'm an American every day. I made a home here. I cook dinner every night. Of course you're invited.
This is Wider Window Poetry on KBOO FM. My guest this month is Alex Dang. Here's your completely random question. If you could learn to play one musical instrument that you don't already know how to play, what would it be and why?
Okay, I have three answers. Two of them are ridiculous. One of them is real. There are two instruments that I just think would be fun to learn how to play because they are just wild instruments. The theremin, I think, is like the really fun, like, woo 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 guy. And then I think the accordion would just be very fun because it looks very difficult, but like there's a lot of stuff in there. But realistically, I would love to learn how to play the piano. I do know how to play trombone, but it's been a little bit, and I still only know how to read in bass clef, so we'll see if my piano career will start.
All right, thank you so much. And thank you for joining us this month. Listeners, this is Wider Window Poetry. Stay safe out there, and we'll hope to hear from you again next month. Thank you and goodbye.
KBOO, Portland.